Coming up on this edition of the Golf Digest podcast, we preview the 2018 Ryder Cup and have a chat with past British Open champ and Team USA veteran Stuart Sink.
My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Well, why do they even have one if you're not supposed to hit it there?
Because it's fun! We're having fun!
What is this, custom? Mine's off the rack.
I wish Tiger Woods was here to help me with this.
We'll do it live!
Welcome back to the Golf Digest podcast. I'm Alex Myers. Today I'm joined in studio by Sam Wyman, Steve Hennessy, and Joel Beal. We got a full roster because this is a huge week.
Ball.
Yeah, we got a four ball. And we'll be doing some foursomes, a little alternate
not
shot.
Not alternate shot, though. Don't call
don't,
it that.
Don't call it that. John Huggin, our colleague, doesn't
except
like it.
Except Bryson didn't
that.
Know what foursome or
he didn't.
Four ball was today.
The
He's
smartest
like, wow.
man in the Ryder Cup could not
no
get
idea.
Those two terms figured out, which was pretty remarkable. Guys, it's only Tuesday, obviously. We've got a couple more days till this starts. But we had a little bit of potential news today in the practice pairings, the pods, so to speak. The guys went on three different foursomes. And in one, Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth were not grouped together. Joel, is it possible that we're seeing the end of this marquee pairing for Team USA?
It is possible, especially in the sense that there's been rumors the past couple weeks that one of the two might have been asked to separate the combo. Now, Furyk did temper this or preface it by he separated the groups today. He wanted to make sure each group had two guys who have played the course before, mentioning that, yeah, there are some guys out there who are going to be teamed up, but today's pods are not necessarily representative of what you're going to see on Thursday. But, yeah, I think if you look at what news kind of came out today, that Reed and Spieth were in two different groups, I think is newsworthy.
What do you guys think?
First
of all, do you think that they should stay together or does it matter?
I think if you're Jim Furyk, what you have to do is play the percentages. I don't care what you think, but when you're the Ryder Cup captain, you have to protect against making a huge mistake. Well, there are two things that most people agree would be a huge mistake. One would be splitting those two up based on past success. The other would be putting Tiger and Phil together. And both of those pairings were intact today. You had Tiger and Phil play together. They're not going to play together. I think it's really more about learning the golf course. It's also about getting guys just games ready. And if anything, you have 3 days of this. This is such a marathon to prepare for this event that I don't think you want to play with your playing partner the first day anyway.
Really?
Yeah, I just think that you need to play golf. Just worry about your game, and then when it comes to Wednesday and Thursday,
the whole Paul Azinger stuff?
You overprepare. I think it becomes
But Steve, I mean, if you were going to play with someone now, again, you could make the argument. Well, Reed and Spieth have already played a lot. Actually, I was just telling Joel this when I was doing my Ryder Cup stats thing. They've played more matches together than any pairing in U.S. history. Seven.
Wow.
It's seven. I mean, it's weird that seven's the record because I think there was like 12 Euro teams that have played more than that. Mm-hmm. But the U.S., just for whatever reason, they don't have these guys stick together for, you know, decades. But anyway, wouldn't you want to spend as much time with the partner?
I mean, they have spent a lot of time together. They're probably very comfortable playing together. And, yeah, maybe it's possible they don't play, you know, four matches together. But I would guess that they start paired together at least. And then Furyk has the option of splitting them up if they don't play that great, because Spieth has been struggling a little bit. Reed hasn't had a great end of the season. So, you know, maybe it does make sense to pair one of them, with Phil or Tiger in a Saturday match. So I guess he's just leaving possibility open to split them.
Yeah.
Who would you see Reed pair with? Because I think a lot of people saw the pods today and thought, oh, DJ with Spieth, we've seen that in the past in the President's Cup and Ryder Cup. However, Reed was with Tiger, Phil, and DeChambeau. So out of those three, who would Reed theoretically, in your mind, play with?
Well, Phil, just because by process of elimination, I think we're all assuming that Tiger's going to play with Bryson, at least start, at least have a go with that. I mean, neither of them have shot down that possibility. They both seem to have embraced it, if anything. So, and I could see Phil with Patrick Reed. Although you would be pairing up two of the biggest personalities. I think we were talking earlier that Spieth, almost in a way, it's a lose-lose if he plays with Patrick Reed, because if they win, Reed gets kind of all the credit. And if they lose, I think more people will instantly point to Spieth struggles, even though, I mean, Patrick Reed hasn't done that much since he won the Masters. Yeah. I mean, he almost won the U.S. Open, but, you know, Spieth, we're talking about this drought that he's on, sure, and how, I mean, for him, he had a bad season. So I think, you know, Reed kind of takes the spotlight from that pairing.
Especially how
demonstrative he is. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, in a way, it's, you know, I bet Spieth is thinking, especially before this year when Reed won the Masters, you know, I'm a three-time major champ. This guy's getting all the credit. He's Captain America. He's beating his chest, which is awesome. Everybody seems to like it. But it probably is a tough spot for, you know, to be his partner. You're the mental guy. What do you think?
I just think, I go back to what I said before, is that if you spend 3 days playing with the same guy, I think you just work yourself up in a knot. And so I'm just not going to read too much into it. I think the safe money is that those two will be together for all of Friday.
Hmm.
Because yeah, based on past success, again, part of being, especially coming off of a winning Ryder Cup, that's the biggest thing. So if you're Jim Furyk, the first order of business is don't mess this up. Okay, well, some of the work's already been done for you. And that's a known entity, right? And so, like I said, the other thing is not doing anything that's going to disrupt the team dynamic too much. And so the other one, like I said, is the Tiger and Phil.
And not only the Hazel team, but they did play four matches together at Liberty National last year and won 3.5 points out of four possible points. So clearly it's not just...
Well, there wasn't really another team when they played. That was a dominant. It's like they should just throw out all President's
Cup. Beat down.
Right.
Okay, Phil, Tiger, though. You're saying it's not going to happen. Phil today, again... This guy is the ultimate promoter. I mean, so anything he does, I don't even believe necessarily, and he's all trying to promote this, you know, match with Tiger Woods. But he was asked specifically about playing with Tiger. He definitely didn't deny it. In fact, he said, we would both embrace it. And then he said, well, what about what's Furyk doing? He goes, yeah, he's got an idea what he's doing. And he was very coy, as, you know, typical Phil. I don't know. I kind of... Maybe I got suckered in there. I'm kind of reading into the fact that they might give them a crack together.
Let me ask you a question. If you're Jim Furyk, or even Phil Mickelson for that matter, to what extent are you at all concerned about tipping your hand to Thomas Bjorn? Which is to say that's
true.
Does Thomas Bjorn really do anything differently if he knows that they're going to play it and doesn't know? Right.
No, but these things are all overanalyzed.
I know.
So it's absurd. It is great, but it's absurd. You're right. They're not going to adjust to that. It's not like, you know, Bill Belichick putting guys on the injured list and, like, you know, having teams have to prepare for a guy or not a guy. Yeah, this is not that situation, but yet they treat it like it is. But I don't know. I think they could get a chance. But again, Phil is so, I hate to use the word sick, but like he's
careful.
He could have forced Furyk into letting them get a shot.
Would
again,
you be surprised?
Just to promote the match.
All,
I would not be surprised.
And to be clear about this, you know, however many years ago, 14 years ago when those two were paired together, is it 14? Yeah. When they were paired together at Oakland Hills, the undercurrent was they don't really get along well together. Why would you pair them together? Obviously, that's not the case anymore. They obviously get along fine. They're good buddies. They give each, you know, on that level, it's perfectly fine. I think more it's like one guy's playing out of his mind really well, and one guy's not. And, you know, they're two kind of alpha males. Why would you put them together?
But wouldn't you maybe pair the guy who's playing well with the guy who's not? I mean, if you're going to play the guy who's not playing well, who else are you going to play
him with? I don't know. I just think that, again, talk about overanalyzing. If I'm Jim Furyk, another thing that I want to do is Tiger Woods is your horse, and he's a big from a symbolic standpoint, beating Tiger Woods is worth more than a point.
Yeah.
And so you need to put him in the best position to succeed, because when Team Europe comes out and it's Tyrrell Hatton and – you know, whomever taking down Tiger Woods in a match, that gives a lot of, infuses a lot of belief into the European team room.
Phil loved playing with Keegan Bradley, obviously, and they had a great rapport. And I see, you know, Patrick Reed is a similar.
No, that's a good point. Fiery.
I could see, in a way, you know, let's ignite Phil, let's get him going. I could even see him going to Captain Furyk and saying, look, I need the spark to be lit. Give me this young guy, Reed. Give me Captain America.
Fino actually pops out a little bit of someone who can kind of let Phil be in the spotlight. Fino's making his rookie appearance, can kind of ease his way in there without...
I don't know if he's excitable enough, though. I think Phil really wants to get the juices. Yeah. Like,
you saw him with Kisner at Liberty National.
Yeah.
And he was kind of more similar to Fino, like just kind of in the background. And
he also,
they paired well together.
He was in President's Cup, so he also paired with Zach Johnson in 2015. And those guys were...
Complete opposite.
The epitome of the failed high five was on display throughout that weekend.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
There's a couple advantages like to, see to it. You know, like you said, Phil's the ultimate promoter.
Right.
So this is like the next step in the promotion of their head-to-head matches, putting them together. Also, the advantage is kind of changing that narrative from 04 at Oakland Hills.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's brought up so much with them. If they played well together and it goes well, then that's finally.
But how does that benefit Jim Furyk?
It doesn't.
No,
he's
it doesn't.
Gotta win. He's got
to win. And Sam's right. And these captains, you know, it's the same with NFL coaches. These guys don't want to make a move that can blow up in their face.
Right.
It's all about
safer.
You look at Thomas Bjorn's captain's picks. He picked the most name brand established guys, right. and that's the safest way to go. So you're right. Like putting Tiger Phil together, you know, if it works, people will say, "Well, okay, good for you." But if it backfires again, they're going to
be like,
you already saw this didn't work, and you did it again.
I'm glad you brought that up because to me, I feel like those captain's picks for Europe are the biggest storyline going into it because I think almost individually they're defensible. I mean, Ian Poulter, I think, was a no-doubter. But then after that, even you could say, I understand where Sergio's coming from, Stenson, Casey, but in the aggregate, it seems like there's a lot of question marks. I think the average age is 41 between all four of those four guys. So especially given, I think, a lot of people credit it 2016's failure was bringing in Keimer and Westwood strictly because of veteran experience. Were you surprised at all that they did exactly what kind of caused the failure of 2016?
Well, no, just because, again, they were these quote safe picks, even though they're not the safe picks. Mm-hmm. They seem like the safe picks on paper. I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, I agree with Joel. I think the whole matches are going to swing on those four captains picks because the U.S. captains picks, again, Phil's struggling, but we're talking about DeChambeau, Tiger, and Tony Finau, who's as hot as anybody.
The columns will be pre-written.
If
Sergio has anything other than a winning record, then Bjorn will be lambasted for it because it was a pick that was based on experience and not at all based on form.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if he has a bad week, a lot of people, especially in the European press, are going to take him to task for it. So that's the one area where he is subject to criticism. And again, maybe it was the right call just based on what you feel like you need. But I guarantee you that if Europe loses, and especially if Europe loses and Garcia has a tough week, Bjorn will take it on the chin for that.
Ooh, yeah, he really will.
I mean, even Stenson, too. I mean, this is a guy who's been hurt.
Yeah, he's been exactly.
At least struggled. With Sergio, you can say maybe this week, and he did play well in his last term in Europe, so at least he's kind of turning and slowing around. But Stenson's been lost all year, and understandably so. If messed up wrist is usually a death blow for a guy. So, and it was very weird, too. I know we brought this up before, but how in the press conference, he justified the pick by saying, well, I don't know how Justin Rose would do if Stenson wasn't here. And like at the time, Rose was number two golfer in the
that's
world.
Absurd.
It was such a weird
that's
comment.
Absolutely that. That's ridiculous.
That's another thing I feel like I'm going to be interested to see how those two go.
Well, and also, you know, one name that really jumped out that he left off was Thomas Peters, especially based on the fact that he won his last four matches at Hazeltine. He was really the lone bright spot for Europe. But we hear more and more about this course, Le Golf National, which has hosted the French Open, obviously, but is getting its first crack at a Ryder Cup, and it's not a bomber's course. I mean, they're certainly long holes where if you can, you know, hit a 350-yard drive down the middle, you're not going to be hurt. But a lot of guys, John Rahm, Justin Thomas, who played in the French Open this year, they're talking about how they're going to hit a lot of five woods and maybe some three woods off the tee and some three irons. I mean, not, you know, Ryder Cup, you're used to seeing guys really bomb it and go for a lot of birdies, but this course, there's just so much water in play. So maybe Thomas Peters, back to Thomas Peters, someone like that wasn't as slam dunk of a pick as we thought. So how much should you tailor maybe these picks around the course, or should that not be as big of a factor?
Well, I think if you're Bjorn, you're tailing around the players you feel like can perform, but also it's also about negating American advantage, right? And so a lot of it has to do with, you know, the Americans are going to have tons of bombers. We need to select some players who are going to, you know, perform under this type of test. So, you know, I think he knew going in the type of golfer that would play well on that course, and he knows that, you know, maybe he goes out of his way to pick players who are a little bit of a departure from the American lineup.
Yeah, and I mean that's where you know, a Poulter comes in. I mean, that, you know, this, I've heard some comparisons, Steve, ask you about this course. I've heard some comparisons actually from this course to TPC Sawgrass, mm-hmm. where it's not a, you know, again, not a bomber's course. You're not going to hit that many drivers. You're going to have to hit a variety of shots off the tee to just kind of put yourself in position. Yeah. And then that's where you attack from. And Poulter certainly kind of fits that. And Francesco Molinari, similar type guy. It's so
really, precision is key. Yeah. And the way that Bjorn's going to set up the course is even more so that, you know, he's growing the rough out just off the fairway, more to that European advantage. So he probably is choosing guys who are going to, you know, fit how he's setting up the course. So, yeah, I think visually you're right. It does seem like TPC Sawgrass a bit. Also, because it's such a stadium atmosphere, you know, 60,000 people are going to be there, and this venue really suits
that.
And
a fair amount of trouble, too, right? Like some
water. Yeah, a lot of water, especially over the last four holes. So if you look at the French Open this year, Julien Seury had a chance to win, and he double bogeyed 18, dunked it in the water. Same thing with Chris Wood. He, you know, went in the water, I think, on 15 and 17. Mm-hmm. John Rahm went in the water on 13. He had a chance to win, too. So there's a lot of trouble. Especially down the stretch, which I think is why this is going to be a good Ryder Cup venue, but, you know, also speaks to how precision is key. Alex Noren, he won the French Open this year. He finished in like the fifth to last group. You know, he was in the clubhouse and everyone just kind of, you know, crapped the bed a little bit. So
I mean, you mentioned a guy like Noren. I think Francesco Molinari has a great track record there. Actually, that's the tournament he skipped. Mm-hmm. To come to Quicken Loans.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
And he won by eight there, so that was pretty impressive. But no, yeah, that final four holes is going to be brutal, especially the 18th hole. Like a 400, I think it's back-to-back 470-plus par fours to finish. And 18, I just saw a quote, John Rahm called it top five toughest holes that he's ever played.
Wow.
You know, other guys say how difficult it is. Now, again, these matches, you never know if they're actually going to get there. But once you get to 15, those last four holes, a lot of water involved. They're all kind of located. It kind of seems like it's going to be like that area at the Travelers. Where you have that whole that nice.
That's exactly what DJ officials want.
That is a great tournament.
It is. It is. And for viewing,
it's great. Exactly. You can see my point is you can see three or four holes at the same time.
Similar to Sawgrass too. Just go behind 17 and see that all.
So I don't know. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a different kind of test from Hazeltine, that's for sure, right? I mean,
I think that's actually one of the reasons why people were a little surprised by the captain's picks. Aside from Casey, who does fit that bill of keeping it in the fairway, I think people thought Matthew Fitzpatrick would play really well in this course, where his distance isn't really an issue for him. It's not as keely tail like it usually is, and he's one of the straightest drivers in golf. And you go with Sergio, who's hitting the ball all over the planet at the moment.
Right.
So I think that something could be brought up. You mentioned Rahm. I think he's going to be one of the more interesting characters because he's been one of the best players, really, since he's turned pro and after the Oakmont U.S. Open. However, it does seem like some of the European guys, like it's been reported in multiple places now where Rory's kind of had to take him under his wing and somewhat control him. What do you see from Rahm this week? Because he's a guy who can roll off five birdies and six holes like that. And as we've seen, though, he also lets his emotions get the best of him. So what do you think about Rahm?
Well, you know, he had a decent, like Steve was saying, he had a chance at the French Open. He's had a couple decent finishes there. So obviously he can play this course pretty well. That being said, though, we kind of think of him. I know, Joel, you wrote that great piece earlier in the year about the bomb and gouge guys. We do kind of think of him as he's more of an American style player, Rahm. So
he does have the creativity around the green, though, I think, which is
great. Right. But he's not one of these, you know, put in position off the tee, great long iron player, mid iron player like that. So I don't know if the course sets up that well for him, but certainly the fire that we know he has, this is the event where he can showcase that and not have people criticize him. You know, we see Patrick Reed, what people vilify Patrick Reed the rest of the year, but they love him at the Ryder Cup. So I'm excited to see Rahm on this stage. It's going to be the first of many times, obviously. we'll see if he gets the Sergio pairing or anything. You know, if they do the try to rekindle some of the Spanish magic that they've had in the past. I don't know.
What's interesting is that obviously emotion is such a big part of the Ryder Cup, but one thing you don't see very often is a guy having a meltdown the way we've seen Rahm have in a Ryder Cup. I think it's because it's such an incredibly selfish thing to do in that format. You can't, you know, throw your club or have a big fit just because it ends up being distracting, not just to yourself. So I think his emotion in that regard will be fine. I think it'll only be a positive thing for him. But you're right. It'll be interesting to see how he adapts to it because he's, in a lot of ways, he is more of a prototypical American player than he is, you know, the classic European, you know, strategic positional player.
He does have, at least it's a friendly crowd. You know, if this was Hazeltine, it could be a different story. If he starts going south, and I can see the crowd getting to him a little bit. Yeah, but there's really nobody really getting on Rahm, you would like, unless there's some American fans scattered about that get under his edge.
The American crowds would not be as nice to him if, you know, if he started bugging out. But it'll be fun to see him under that pressure. I think Tyrell Hatton, too, is the same sort of temperament.
Yep, definitely.
So they both could kind of harness that, you know, fieriness, and it'll be fun to watch.
Who's the key player, well, for both teams, do you think? Who's one guy on each team that's kind of the key or a couple guys?
I'm interested to see Tommy Fleetwood. He's been such a good player over the last 2 years, but I was just thinking about, you know, his strengths are, like you were just saying, his long irons are so good. He's pretty straight off the tee, and he's really good at making birdies, so you would think he'd be good in a match play setting, but we've just never really seen him in this atmosphere, and how is he going to handle the Ryder Cup? You would think he's such a strength for the Europeans, but he's kind of unproven, so I'm interested to see how he does. For the Americans, you know, I think DeChambeau has been playing so well coming into this that you see him as a, you know, as a potential strength, but he's also never handled these Ryder Cup emotions, so that'll be interesting to see, too, kind of how these young guys do.
I'm going with Justin Thomas just because he's had the mentioned he's battling with a bit of a wrist ailment. Very successful last year with Ricky Fowler, but this is make his Ryder Cup debut here, and another guy who can get fiery at times, and I think he enjoys it. I think he is looking forward to the atmosphere, but you know, he's had as good of a year he's had, not coming in firing in all cylinders by any means, so it'll be interesting to see how he adapts to the environment. And this is the guy who should be making Ryder Cups for the next two decades or so. So I'm looking forward to that.
I actually am looking mostly at the guy who has been kind of relegated to being known as Justin Thomas's friend, Jordan Spieth. I think this is closer than people think, especially with the being on the road. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jim Furyk's going to play Spieth. He's counting on him. So whether he plays with Patrick Reed or not, he needs to play up to, you know, a standard that we're used to seeing. And especially in alternate shot, he is dangerous with some of these wild tee shots. Yeah, I mean, although it does seem like most of the trouble on this course is left. There's a lot of tee shots where water's on the left. And we've seen Jordan, obviously, that big miss to the right. But, man, I really think he's the key to the U.S. this week.
I totally agree. And I was saying before about sort of symbolic players who sort of – the rest of the team feeds off of him, and I would definitely put Spieth in that category. And on the European side, I would say Rory as well, which is, you know, we talked about this a lot recently, that Rory's had on many levels a good year for, you know, Thursday through Saturday, and then against a Sunday he struggles. So if he struggles right off the bat, again, that's a big momentum killer for Team Europe, and potentially something that the Americans can feed off of. So similar to Spieth in that regard, I feel like, you know, if he is sort of playing well and they feed off of his energy, especially given what happened between him and Reed in 2016, that could be a really positive thing for Team Europe, but it could also go the other way in a hurry.
Yeah,
it's crazy to think that Spieth was the only American player who didn't make the Tour Championship out of the American side.
Well, it's a great team. We were talking about before, maybe a week or two ago. It's gotten even better because now Tiger's ranked 13th in the world. Phil Mickelson is the lowest ranked player, and he's 25th in the world. Wow. So that is a strong team. And Team Europe is pretty strong. I mean, other than these captains' picks, a couple of them who have drifted a little further down than what we're used to seeing in the ranking, it's strong. I mean, overall, you have 17 of the top 18 players in the world playing this week. Wow. So I think no matter what, we're going to see a lot of great golf for sure. But, you know, the guy who was ranked one, he actually lost it even though he won the $10 million. Justin Rose, we haven't even really mentioned him yet. And, Sam, you talk about, like, symbolic wins against, you know, the opposing team. He's number one, but do you – I mean,
no,
he doesn't
like,
have that. Right.
The last two big – quote unquote wins where yeah. when he became number one in the world,
right.
he didn't win.
And he lost.
And he didn't win. Yeah. He won the FedEx Cup. So it's like hard to
right.
really come in with any sort of swagger.
Yeah. I mean, he's so good consistently. But for whatever reason, like you said, them mentioning, oh, he kind of needs Stenson mm-hmm. or, you know, right, these guys kind of taking him down one on one.
Didn't have a great Ryder Cup either in 2016. I think he played
yeah.
five times and only won 2 points.
I mean, now again, and I think this kind of sparked when him winning the U.S. Open even the following year, but. That finish at Medina against
yep.
Phil Mickelson
yeah.
was
killing.
Remarkable. I mean, he pulled that win out. So that, I mean, look, he can definitely, obviously, he's, you know, number one in the world as of last week. He can get it done. But you were just talking about that. He doesn't bring that intimidation mm-hmm. factor.
Can I ask you an important yeah. question? Give me your, since none of us are in Paris, we have a whole team that's there for us, or in France.
Oh boy.
Give me your routine for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Wake up, you can have a baguette in the morning. Just a cup of.
Well, I love croissants, actually.
There you go.
Plain croissants.
Okay.
Can't have anything in them. Butter croissants. If you, yeah.
Nice latte
do that.
In the morning.
I don't drink coffee.
He doesn't drink coffee. Yeah. I'll have Diet Pepper.
Yeah.
Diet Dr. Pepper.
Had to get the real thing today. They didn't have the diet.
What time does coverage start? 3 a.m.?
It starts at 2.
Might be
2. I believe.
Two.
So it's a 6-hour difference.
Yeah.
So you get 8 a.m.
It's going to be early. I don't know how early I'm getting up.
You're up that early for the new
for the
baby, though, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I was today. Oh, my God.
Beret or no beret?
No beret.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can see you actually making a beret work, like being part of your normal ensemble.
Don't encourage it, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Maybe a little pencil mustache. Okay? Just making such all French cliches. Like, French people probably listen to us.
Yeah, they're like, what the?
Jackass Americans.
All right, well, enough about my routine on during the Ryder Cup this week. We, Steve and I, just recently chatted with a guy who's very familiar with the Ryder Cup routine, Stuart Sink, a member of 5 U.S. teams, only one winning team, unfortunately, 2008, but that was a memorable team. We talked to him about that, about playing, being a teammate with Tiger, about playing with Anthony Kim, and, you know, about a lot of other stuff. He's had a underrated career, really, right, Steve?
Very underrated. Yeah. Made over $37 million in his career. You know, had the 2009 Open win over Tom
Watson. Of course.
6 PGA Tour wins, mm-hmm. 5 Ryder Cups, 4
yep.
Presidents
Cups. 4 Presidents Cups, yep.
I mean, you think of Stuart Sink, you think of the Open. You don't necessarily think of 5 Ryder Cups.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it shows how consistent of a player he was in his prime.
Sure. And at 45 this year, he still had 8 top 25s,
yeah.
3 top 10s. He had a runner-up at the Travelers. Travelers, we're talking about the Travelers.
A lot of Travelers.
A lot of Travelers talk. Bone, where's Bone? Filling in for him. Anyway, please have a listen to our talk with Stuart Sink.
Okay, before we get to Stuart Sink, this interview is brought to you by Golf Digest Schools. Golf Digest Schools is our new cutting-edge video instruction platform offering more than 250 classes on every part of the game and featuring the leading teachers in golf from Butch Harmon to David Ledbetter to Michael Breed. Unlike the quick tips you can find across the internet, these are full game improvement programs meant to be followed step-by-step as if you were working with a pro. It's like Masterclass meets Netflix. But even better because there's the added promise of feedback. To sign up for Golf Digest Schools, go to golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS to get 30% off an annual subscription. Again, it's golfdigest.com/allaccess and use promo code SCHOOLS.
Okay, we are happy to welcome 6-time PGA Tour winner and 2009 British Open champ Stuart Sink to the podcast for the first time. Stuart, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
All right, well, obviously this is a huge week. Ryder Cup on tap, I'm sure it brings back a lot of memories for you. What do you feel right off the bat when we get to this week every couple years?
Well, the biggest part about it is the anticipation to me, the anticipation of what's going to happen, the conjecture about the picks and the pairings, and there's always some little drama that goes on in the days leading up to the event that is unavoidable these days with social media and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always kind of fun to watch the the pageantry play out, you know, before the matches, and that's really what gets everybody talking. And then the golf starts, and it's just, we switch gears into what is really like an amazing display of ability on the golf course. The level of play at the Ryder Cup is just, it's almost incomprehensible. Hmm. You can't even imagine how much elevated the level of play is until you've been there and seen it.
Yeah, Stuart, you talked about the lead up to the Ryder Cup, and you were teammates with Tiger for many of your five Ryder Cups. Just after his win at the Tour Championship, what do you think of his performance and how he could do for the U.S. leading up, you know, this week at the Ryder Cup, and also just what it says about his career at this point to do what he did?
Well, last week watching Tiger looked like we were turning back the clock, I thought. Didn't you guys think? I didn't watch a lot of it, and I didn't see Sunday, but I went back and watched a little bit of the early round on Saturday where he just pretty much separated himself and kind of got the job done on Saturday, to be honest. And it looked like the Tiger Woods that I've seen over the years winning tournaments by a lot and, stepping on necks. And it looked like he is just gaining momentum and confidence. And I know he'll be a big part of the team this week. It'll be good, too, to see Tiger mix in with a lot of the core group of younger players, you know, that haven't been on the team with Tiger yet.
Sure.
And so that'll be a good asset for them and a good experience for them to experience him in the team room and on the course. Somebody's going to pair up with Tiger, and we don't know who it would be. I would presume maybe it would be Bryson, but it's hard to know exactly what Jim and the assistant captains are thinking.
Yeah, you mentioned him mixing with the younger guys. We've kind of seen that the last 2 years, but in a role as a vice captain. I'm wondering, what was he like as a teammate for you? Obviously, you know, people bring up his record in the team stuff as not being as good, obviously, as everything else he's accomplished. But, you know, what was he like with you, and what were your experiences with him on the team?
Well, he treated the Ryder Cup just like he treated regular golf, which is the way we all did. And that's one of the things that gets you to the top, you know, is you have to be consistent with your routines and your boundaries. And Tiger always stayed faithful to those boundaries and those routines that he used in regular tournament play. And that meant that he was kind of off to himself during some of the preparation times, but also in the team room, he was real loose and he loved playing ping pong, and I'm sure those guys are going hard at the ping pong over there again this year. It's like a story to the Ryder Cup every year. Who's the ping pong champ? And it's a big deal to the U.S. guys. but Tiger was always really good. He was professional. He was a part of the team, but he was also making sure that he got his job done. And you know, to speak to his record being maybe less glamorous than as far as wins in the Ryder Cup play versus his on-course stroke play individual record, I think that just can be said, easily explained by the fact that the target was on his back more than anybody else.
Mm.
And that plus he played through the time when U.S. team was losing a lot of Ryder Cups. And sure. They had a lot of confidence. They felt like they could win everything for about 10 years, it seemed like. And Tiger played through that and accumulated a few losses during that time. But with target on your back, it's hard to – when you're playing against the very best that the other team can bring you every time, it's just the level of the golf is really high.
Well, not to make excuses for him, but he's played with 12 different partners in 7 Ryder Cups, and 6 of those guys, I was looking this up, he only played one match with. So he never really had a consistent guy. But I'm wondering, do you think there's a reason for that? And obviously, you never got a chance to play with him. Would you have liked to do that? And how much pressure is it on his partner as well?
Well, I can't speak to the pressure on the partner because I never was his partner.
Right.
So I can speak to the pressure of playing with him in stroke play. And, you know, it's a little bit of a different ballgame playing with Tiger Woods the first few times. No question about that. So it can affect people different ways. I would have liked to get a chance to play with him just because, you know, it would go down the history books that I partnered up with Tiger during the Ryder Cup or the Presidents Cup. But those, I'll have to qualify for the team next year and we'll partner up, I guess.
That's good.
to make that happen.
There you go.
I don't know. It would have been fun. It's always exciting. I played with Tiger this year at the PGA on Saturday, and I've played with him a lot over the years. I mean, I played with him When he won on Sundays, I played with him when I won on Sundays.
Right.
Played with him on major Sundays and Saturdays over the years. Saturday in St. Louis was the loudest I've ever heard the crowd in my life. It was right up there with the Ryder Cup.
Wow.
In St. Louis that day. It was amazing. Amazing energy. And it just tells me that the golf world is just like hungry for more Tiger Woods. He's like cowbell. Everybody's hungry for more Tiger Woods.
That's right.
We've got a fever. We need more Tiger. That's true. So, Stuart, you're in 5 Ryder Cups in your career, and as you mentioned, you didn't play with Tiger, but, you know, you played with a bunch of different teammates over the years. You know, guys who come to mind, Chad Campbell at Valhalla in 08, Matt Kuchar you played with in Wales in 2010. Do you have a favorite pairing or a favorite teammate who, you know, when you think back to your 5 Ryder Cups, you know, you think to that, you know, one partner or, you know, a pairing that kind of stands out to you?
Well, my first Ryder Cup, I played with Jim Furyk in my first match. And I was just happy to be getting on the course because I'd sat out the first match. So you sit out and then, you know, you're waiting. We had the delay from 9/11.
Right.
So we had to wait a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, I sit out the first match. So I have to wait an extra 5 hours.
Jeez.
And I'm just like, come on, I just want to get out there and play. Just give me something to do with my hands. I need to do something. And so for that reason, that one being one of the reasons, that was one of my favorite matches I ever played, was my first ever match with when I paired with Jim Furyk, and we got a win. And Jim told me after that it was his first win in team play, which was shocking to me. I thought that he would have won many, many points, but he told me that was his first win, and so that was a really fun match for me just to get out there and play with Furyk. And then once I got a little bit more experience, I enjoyed being the player that the leader of the team and playing with the younger rookie or a less experienced player.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I could bring some stability to the game and to the match, and you know, some level-headed decision making on strategy. And I told the captains that I would like that role, and so that probably explains why I never paired up with Tiger. I enjoyed playing with Matt Kuchar, who was the first time Ryder Cup player that year, and we had some really good results against some of their biggest pairings. Rory and Graham McDowell were a real pillar of their team, and we beat them and tied them. I don't think they ever beat us in that Ryder Cup, and so that was really fun. And but I always enjoyed playing with the new guys. You know, Chad Campbell wasn't a rookie, but he had less experience than I did when I played with him, and we had a big win that Ryder Cup against Poulter and Justin Rose, where we were 3 down and came back to win.
Wow.
So that was one of my great memories too.
Well, that was nice of Jim to not let you know about his record before the match. It probably would have put a little more pressure on you.
Well, a funny story about that one, too, is that we played our practice round, me and Furyk, and we knew we were going to be partnered up the first day. We didn't know what round it would be, but we were going to be paired with, I guess we did know, because it was going to be alternate shot. Back in those days, it was best ball first and alternate shot second. And so I knew I was going to be sitting out the first match. But we decided that I was going to hit off the odd holes and Jim was going to hit off the even holes because it fit into our games better. About 10 minutes before the bell rung and it was almost time to go to the tee, I was listening to the chants on that first tee, and I was pretty much a nervous wreck. I went over to Jim on the putting green and I said, hey, I've been thinking about this. I think maybe you ought to take the odds. And I didn't have to explain it. He knew exactly what I meant. And so he's like, he kind of put his hand on my shoulder and said, you got it, buddy. Don't worry.
Wow.
So we had to adjust our strategy a little bit because
That's
of
great.
Me. Like, I don't want the first shot.
That's
and great. Then he hit it, and he actually hit the absolutely perfect shot for me, because he didn't hit the fairway, but he hit it in the first cut, which gave me like an inch cushion under the ball. I mean, you know, a beginner could have made solid contact with the ball.
That's funny, yeah.
So I hit the shot up on the green, and I'm thinking, finally, my first shot in the Ryder Cup's out of the way. You know, now I can just get down to playing golf and business, and I can be comfortable. And we get up there on the green, it's about 25 feet, and Jim kind of takes a run at the putt and runs it about 4 or 5 feet past. And so here I am again, like, oh, no, my heart's up in my throat again. I got a 5-footer on the first hole and knocked that one in and calmed down, and we played great. We actually played really well and won that match on about 16, I think it was.
You know, you recently, I think, talked to Alan Shipnuck about separating the golfer from the nervous golfer. And obviously, I would think that the Ryder Cup, like you said, I mean, the nerves can be at an all-time high there. What was there any, you know, how did you handle the pressure and specifically during those weeks?
Well, yeah, and what I was referring to when I did that interview with Alan was, it's not that you have to separate the two. You just have to understand what happens when either one of them is present. Like, okay. I know I'm a golfer, and then I know how I behave and how my golf ball behaves when I'm a nervous golfer. You have to learn both of those, you know, situations. And the Ryder Cup, pretty much you stay in nervous golfer mode the whole time. And nervous doesn't mean, like, scared nervous. It just means, like, super hyped, adrenaline. You're jacked, you know, and you got to know what your ball flight and your distances and your putting and your short game. You just have to understand all that. And the Ryder Cup gives you just an unbelievable bank of memories to draw on when it comes to the nervous golfer side of things. And because the main difference between the Ryder Cup and regular tournament play is that tournament play builds up towards the end. And sure, I mean, it feels like a lot of pressure when you get that tournament on the line, majors, even regular tournaments. There's a ton of pressure and heat at the end. But the Ryder Cup, it starts on the first tee, and it just doesn't end. It stays escalated the whole way. And that's a, you know, if you play 18 holes, that's a five-hour learning experience for you to figure out what you do when you're nervous. And it's just huge to know that, because it puts you in a better position when you're in contention for a win, better than the guy you're playing against.
Yeah, you got a couple rookies on this team. You mentioned Bryson, Justin Thomas, who, you know, doesn't seem like a rookie. He's had such big experience, but you know, you look at this U.S. team, and you know, they won in 2016, and you know, kind of seem like they've turned it around with all the talent they have. I just wonder, being one of the veterans from those U.S. Teams, you know, back in your last cup was 2010, but how do you just assess the state of the U.S. team and how they've kind of, you know, transitioned to, you know, what seems to be a good spot moving forward with the task force that seemed to work out in the end? Just how do you assess how the U.S. team kind of transitioned here?
Well, yeah, I like the state of our team right now. I think that there's some of the tension that existed back in the decade before now, back when I was making my Ryder Cup appearances. There was a little bit of a tension there that felt like the players were sort of being led around by, you know, like horses or whatever, led around by leads. And I think that's gone now, that the players have a little bit more say in the scheduling and the construction of the team schedule for the week. Not the players on the team necessarily, but the players, Phil, Tiger, Furyk, Stricker, and Davis. The five of them are kind of like making a lot more decisions now than they were. That's kind of what the task force has boiled down to. So I think that the players are just in a lot more calmness about the Ryder Cup. And then you add to it, you've got a core group of young players who are also fairly close to one another. I think everybody's familiar with the friendship that Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas have, and Ricky's in that group, and Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka are really tight. And so we got a lot of really close friendships on the team, too, and those make for good pairings sometimes. And sometimes it's good to split them up. You don't know what the captains are thinking, you know, behind closed doors when it comes to pairings. But I like our team. I think we've got a good core group of young players who are going to be at this for quite a while. And they'll probably build some good memories. And they'll lose some Ryder Cups, too. But I think they're going to be very, very competitive and hard to beat.
You know, obviously, Hazeltine, the U.S. kind of stopped this skid of European dominance in the event. But in the middle of that was 2008, and you were a part of that team. And I'm just wondering what, you know, obviously, Paul Azinger gets a lot of credit for his captaincy that year. But, you know, what do you remember about that team specifically, why it worked? And did you have the sense that week that you were going to do so well?
2008, we were coming off a string of losses that were pretty heartbreaking and pretty one-sided, too, and we were kind of discouraged. And along comes Paul Azinger and his idea to captain the team in a systematic way that was way different than we ever had experienced before. where he matched personalities to personalities, and he put everybody in groups of what he called pods that almost acted like three separate teams in one. We had four-person pods with similar personalities. We played practice rounds together. We ate dinner together, not in separate rooms, but our tables and our wives and girlfriends were all together. That was I was kind of like the captain of my pod, which included Ben Curtis and Chad Campbell and Steve Stricker. And they were my responsibility. I had one of the assistant captains, Dave Stockton, was the assistant in charge of our pod. I was sort of the player captain of our pod, and they were my responsibility in 24 hours a day. And I knew that I could control that group and not keep them under my thumb or anything, but that was what I was responsible for. Get my group points, and everybody else could do their job getting their group points. And it gave us something else to latch onto other than just, like, let's march out on the stage and wave the stars and stripes and lose, because that's what we had been doing before. Right. And so Zinger gave us a different kind of a system to be excited about, and he laid out his plan to every one of us in a very detailed way. He went about picking the players according to stats and not just sort of a gut or a points list thing. And I just thought it was really good, and it gave everybody something that we could believe in. And we lost a lot of the experience from before of losing because we were doing something different now. And we thought, hey, we got something different to bring to the table. And everybody bought in, and it translated to wins on the course and a Ryder Cup win. It was a really great experience.
Well, you had one young guy that year, Anthony Kim, who became, you know, kind of this legend. And he's, you know, sadly, obviously, we haven't seen him play in years. What do you remember about being on the team with him and you know, kind of the talent that he had?
Well, to say Anthony Kim is new school is probably like the greatest understatement of the century. You know, he was a little different from most of us who came from like golf background and, you know, been playing the tour for years. Anthony Kim brings sort of the sideways hat and the sunglasses and the gold chains into the team room. And it's just a different kind of a thing. And everybody kind of fell in love with it. He was almost like our team pet for most of it. And all the he's also the guy that left the biggest impression on me on the course. And that was when he finished his match against Sergio in the singles and kept playing.
That's right.
Yeah. He tried to keep playing.
The
match was over, and he like was storming off to the next tee, and no one told him, like, Anthony, match play. You don't play all 18 holes. It's over now.
It's amazing.
But that was just how intense he was about winning and not losing and playing his golf the best he could play, and he just was he was dominant. It was amazing.
Yeah, such a big win for the U.S. there at Valhalla. Stuart, before we go into your play over the last couple of years and wrap this up, we wanted to talk about GM Buy Power Card, which you're here to talk about. It's a Capital One card that lets you earn points toward purchasing a new Chevy, Buick, GM, GMC, or Cadillac. If you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing with them.
Sure, thanks. You know, speaking of team play, we've been spending a lot of time talking about the Ryder Cup and the you know, advantages of pairing up the right groups or people together. And part of my team this year that's a new partnership for me is the GM Buy Power Card. And we've had a really good run this summer and back through the early part of the summer, actually, where we've been getting to know each other and doing some really cool film shooting and putting together some spots for their social and for my social, and it's been fun getting to know what their card is all about. And basically, yeah, you mentioned it, the GM Buy Power Card lets you use your spending. We're all trying to take advantage of our spending habits, you know, and let our credit cards and our spending go to work for us, and the Buy Power Card lets you do that, where your rewards go straight to the purchase of a GM vehicle. And so what family can you think of who's not including the purchase of a vehicle in their planning, you know, in the future? And it just makes it a little bit easier. It gives you a car, a vehicle opportunity sooner, or a more appropriate one for your family needs. I know my kids played ice hockey, and I remember the stinky bags, sweaty, gross bags.
It's a smell unlike anything else. It's true.
Oh, my goodness. I could have used something to, you know, to separate that from me, like a pickup truck back in the day. GMC probably would have been very happy, or a Chevy. But the Buy Power card is a way to help you, you know, realize those dreams or those plans in the future and make it come a little sooner and a little easier. And you can apply or learn more at their website, buypowercard.com, BUIPowerCard.com.
Good deal. Yeah, it seems to make sense if you're in the market for a new car. So, you know, talking about performance, over the last 2 years, you've had such a consistent last couple years, and had the T2 at the Travelers this year where you had won in the past. And just wondering, you know, you're 45 now. You're kind of at the point of your career where there's all this young talent on the PGA Tour, and they hit the ball a mile. You know, the strength of your game has always been the putter. And, you know, interestingly, you've been able to kind of figure out how to compete with these young guys, and would ask you how, you know, what you kind of figured out and how you've been able to have such consistent success these past 2 years.
Well, thanks. It's been actually a kind of a role reversal for me. When I first came out in the 90s, I was looking up to players who had been on the tour for their whole careers, you know, Curtis Strange, Peter Jacobson, guys like that who I befriended, who also were veterans of the tour, and I tried to learn exactly like what they did. What did they do to get themselves to the point where they could play their whole career on tour and win, and you know, have that kind of a this steadfast quality of their career that kept them in play. And now that I'm 45, I'm doing the exact opposite. I'm looking back to the younger players to find out what it is that's getting them out on tour and getting them ready to roll and hit the ground running. You know, the players these days don't need like a break-in period like we always used to do back then. I was the youngest player on tour besides Tiger Woods for 3 years, my first 3 years. And so that means that there wasn't a player under 24 for the first 3 years on the PGA Tour. And wow. Now there's probably, I don't even know, I couldn't guess, 25 and players under 24. So I'm looking back now the same way I used to look at the veterans. I'm looking at the young players, like, what are they doing? How are they swinging differently? Because the clubs and balls have changed completely since those days, too. Are we using stats, the launch monitor generation? You know, it's all here. I'm learning from them by watching them and seeing what they do, how they approach the course. Looking at stats like ShotLink, that's a, you know, the available through the PGA Tour, and you see it on TV all the time, the ShotLink stats. Using that to determine like strategy and what pays off in the long run. I'm going back and learning from the younger players now when I learned from the older players when I was a rookie.
Hey, Stuart, before we let you go, you mentioned ping pong before and everything else. We're talking Ryder Cup. What's your all-time USA Team USA ping pong ranking? Where do you slide in? And obviously, we've always heard Matt Kuchar is this wizard. Is he really that good?
Yeah, I think Kuch is probably the best that I've seen on the team. And he's not – he's just like you would figure, just like his golf, he's unorthodox the way he plays. He's like a wall. He just he gets in really close to the table. The ball almost never comes – to the back line, and he's just really quick with his hands, and he just destroys you by letting you make mistakes. That's kind of the way he plays golf too. So I wasn't ranked very high. I was always a good ping pong player growing up. I was probably the best player of the people I knew. You know, I could always win.
Right.
But then when I got to the Ryder Cup, I was just like bottom half.
Wow.
I mean, it's something about the hand-eye coordination and the competitive drive that, I don't know, golfers and ping pong, they just kind of go together. And Tiger, Phil, Furyk, Stricker, Zach, they're all really good players.
They're all good.
Yeah, it's fun watching. I mean, everybody gets really heated. I mean, it gets kind of sweaty in the team room because of that. It's pretty competitive.
Who's better, Tiger or Phil?
I think Tiger was probably a little bit better, but still, again, just like his golf,
Yeah.
Phil was flashy, and he always played the spin shot. I was never good at returning those shots. So he always took me. He always he cleaned the floor with me because he'd hit these weird spinners, and I just didn't know how to handle them.
Sure.
And so I couldn't compete against it. And Phil also always brought his own paddles.
Wow. Yeah, and he's a lefty. Yeah. That's crazy, too. All right, Stuart, thank you so much. Enjoy. I assume you will be watching the Ryder Cup this week and everything else. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. It was really great.
Thanks a lot, Stuart.
You guys.
Good luck next season.
I much appreciate it. And y'all have a great rest of the day.
Thanks, man. You too.
Same to you.
Take care. Thanks again to Stuart Sink for joining us. Before we wrap up, I just want to get some predictions. So, Steve, I'll start with you. What do you see happening in Paris this week?
Well, first, I think Jordan Spieth's going to rise to the occasion. The talk about him going into it is his struggles, but he had a week off because he missed the Tour Championship. That actually might be a benefit to him. He had a chance to work on the game, and I think he's just really going to thrive in this team setting. He's still one of the best putters in the world, even though he hasn't played like it over the last couple months. So I think he's going to be – he is huge to determining how the U.S. does. I'm with you. I think Team Europe has a chance to get this done on home turf. It's been since 93 since
– It's amazing.
The U.S. has gotten this done in Europe. So I don't know. It's going to be a close one. I think it goes down to one of the last couple matches on Sunday, and maybe because of the home turf advantage, I go Team Europe.
Woo! Sam?
I agree with Steve. I actually feel like, you know, on paper, the U.S. is the favorite and the odds are in their favor, but there's a weird reverse psychology when it comes to Ryder Cup, which is the team that is favored to win has the most pressure on them, which frees up the other team to play, you know, relaxed or more relaxed golf and kind of freewheel it a little bit. And that was sort of the calling card of the Europeans through that whole period when they were winning. They were always, on paper, the inferior team. They are a little bit this year, but certainly not, you know, not weak by any means. And I just feel like there's no real correlation between the type of golf you play in the Ryder Cup and how you play stroke play, you know, the other 51 weeks out of the year. And for that reason, I just feel like the Europeans get it more, and I feel like they're going to, you know, seize upon that this week, and they're going to win. And I think they're going to win. I disagree with Steve. I think it's going to be convincing.
Wow. Okay. Joel?
I think it's an American victory. I think it's going to be 2 points for the U.S. I look up and down the roster. The only guy who really comes in as a question mark is Bubba Watson. The guy's missed three cuts at the majors this year, and then 29th last week out of a field of 30. So aside from him, though, even with Phil's struggles, his record in this event's unassailable. Every guy who was basically a captain's pick, everyone agreed with. I just feel like there's too many question marks with the Europeans, not only with their captain's picks, but with how some of these rookies will perform. So I think it's U.S. by two.
I've been going back and forth on it. I was leaning Europe last week. I'm going to go with Team USA, though. I think overall they do have the better team. I know that hasn't always meant that they're going to win. Of course, you still have to make the putts this week. But again, I do think that overall these teams are both very good. I think it's going to be competitive. That 25-year streak is incredible, but at some point it has to break, obviously. I think Team USA is still riding the wave from the last, you know, couple of team events. They feel like they have a system in place now. They feel they're ready to go. And I know a few of those guys struggled at Eastlake at the bottom of the board, but, you know, a lot of those guys were at Eastlake where a lot of the European guys didn't qualify or get there. So I just think overall USA is a little deeper, in part because of those questionable captains picked by Thomas Bjorn. I think that's the difference, and I think they get it done. So I don't know. Anyway, it's going to be fun, that's for sure, and we're going to be getting up early, that's also for sure. And I'm sure everybody out there, this is one of the, you know, most exciting weeks of the season to watch, and we're coming off a pretty exciting week last week. So it's definitely a good time.
This is almost like that Travelers U.S. Open back-to-back
week. Oh, man,
week.
I mean, it can't beat that. Yeah. This is the second best back-to-back stretch on the calendar. Yeah.
Not only do we follow Tiger, Paulina is in Paris. So
and Paulina's in Paris.
Put the money on the minus 240.
Man, yeah.
Banking in.
Definitely. So a lot to look forward to this week. Thanks to Stuart Sink for joining us. Thanks to everybody for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done so already. And check back next week to see who our guest is.